This is Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. Welcome to season three of Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. My, how the time flies. I can't believe we are in season three. We actually have a real thing here, Jimmy. This season, we have a new sponsor, and we're very happy to bring Arcos into the Golf Nuts family. I became friends with Sal Saeed, who is the engineer who came up with this idea. And Golf Nuts is proudly sponsored this year by Arcos, which is, I'm going to read something here. So this is going to sound a little bit like a commercial. So forgive me, but I think we should do it the right way. So take your game from guessing to knowing. The award-winning Arcos Caddy app seamlessly syncs with Arcos Caddy Smart Center sensors in the grip of each club to deliver an unrivaled combination of automatic shot tracking, an AI rangefinder, and stroke gain analytics for every facet of your game to help golfers of all skill levels play smarter and shoot lower scores. The average new Arcos Caddy member improves their handicap 5.02 strokes in the first year. First year membership to the Arcos Caddy app is included with full set purchase of smart sensors or smart grips. And here's the special part, our friends. You get a 15% discount if you use the promo code GolfNuts, GOLFNUSTS, NUTS, just like you would think it is, 15%. Just get on the ArcosGolf.com website and put that in. Now, with that being said, Jim, tell us about season three, episode one, and who our guest is.
Well, our guest is not program, but does a fantastic job too, as Arcos does, of helping people improve their game. So today we've got Dr. Bob Rotella as our first guest to kick off season three of Golf Nuts. Dr. Rotella and I were neighbors in Charlottesville, Virginia, so we've known each other for a number of years, and it's been great to get free advice from him from time to time. And now our audience gets to get some free advice from him and hear about his brand new book, Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot, The Secrets to Playing Great Golf. And it's going to be exciting to really talk to him about that, and also talk to him about some of the players he works with on the tour and some of the success that they've had, and how that fits into some of the things he talks about in his new book.
What, I'm just curious, while we wait for Dr. Bob to join us, what are some tips that he's given you over the years that you take with you in your day-to-day golf activities?
Well, we'll talk about this. I'll talk about this with Dr. Rotella to see if he remembers. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
But one of the first times I shot even par, the very first time I shot even par on nine holes was after a round with Dr. Rotella, where he took me to the driving range right afterwards, had me hit like, I don't know, three or five balls. And I was striping it long and straight. And I went out, played nine holes on our course. We were members at the same club. And I shot even par, had seven pars, one birdie, one bogey.
All right. Well, we'll hear more about that when we bring on Dr. Rotella. Why don't we take a pause here?
Yeah, let's take a pause and then bring him. When we come back, we'll have with us Dr. Bob Rotella. So welcome to Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. We're kicking off season three. Bob has now joined us. Dr. Rotella, great to have you on the show with us tonight, on the podcast with us this evening, and looking forward to chatting with you about your new book. Is this number 12 or 13.
I don't even know anymore, Jimmy.
Quite a few. Well, that's good. So the new one is make your next shot your best shot.
Yep.
And it's really, again, focused on really improving your golf game. So you are just coming in from playing in a tournament today. So I'm going to put you on the spot, and then, you know, Aaron will jump in, but I'm going to put you on the spot. You said you finished second. Why didn't you finish first?
Someone else shot one shot lower than us.
Oh, okay.
You were awesome.
You were awesome. Yeah. So that you approach it, and I know it's a charity event and you're there to raise money, but that you approach it with the idea in mind that you were there, you were in it to win it.
That was the plan. We thought we had done it.
I thought you played well enough to get it done. And that's...
We had to lose it. Someone beat us.
Yes. And
if, you know, I talk about it in a lot of my books. We're very good at redefining winning. You know? we really liked how we played, and we had a good time. So we were fine.
Yeah. So
happy someone else was able to experience winning at our expense.
You were able...
That's a total lie.
So the reason I asked the question the way I ask it, though, because we really do want to talk to you, have an opportunity to talk about your new book and even some of the previous ones and just some of the players you work with. But yeah. What struck me, I did read the book. And
well, it's probably a life-changing experience for you.
Absolutely. And one of the things that struck me again about it was that you got to dream big. You got to set really high goals and get into a routine and stick with it. And so I ask if you had planned to win, because one of the things you talk about is, and we're sort of jumping right into it, but one of the things you talk about that really struck me in the book was how Tiger Woods, if Jack Nicklaus had won 30 plus tournaments, Tiger would probably be at 26 or so, at 20 something today, rather than 15. Can you tell us about how you came to that conclusion? Because that was a really impressional part of the book. That part of the book really struck me in how important it is to really aim high.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where it comes from is from the study of the human mind. We know that we are what we think about ourselves, and we become what we think about ourselves. And because we have a free will, we get to choose whether we're going to believe in ourselves or we're going to believe in someone else. And usually what happens with human beings is we either get everything we're chasing, or if we fail, we come close to it. We call it a comfort zone. So the point is, because Tiger set a goal of breaking Jack's record, we could have predicted he'd win somewhere between 12, 13, or 24 majors. And even if Tiger fails in his quest, he'll end up the second greatest championship winner in history of the game of golf. And when you look at it from that perspective, even if he fails relative to everyone else who's ever played the game of golf, he's the second greatest champion ever. That's pretty good in the story. But I mean, so it doesn't really matter what it is you want. You need to aim higher than that. And, you know, like I was really happy to hear the other day that the Ryder Cup, they were trying to get to 20, you know, and as a result, they got to 19. So they won the Ryder Cup by the largest margin in history, but they actually failed to get to 20, but it drove them to 19. And
right.
it was a good example of what we're talking about in the book. It's the same way, like I think, I forget if it's like 10 people now that have broken 60 on the men's tour. And I was working with six of them when they shot 59 and 58. And I was working with Jim Furyk when he shot 59 and 58. And it's the same idea. You got to be thinking of something better than that if you think too much about 60, you'll get stuck most of the time at 59 or 60. And so he's got to keep going. There's a, my brother sent me an interesting story recently on this point. I'm blocking on his name, but there's a young man in America who had never run the mile in faster than 4:08 in his life. And there's only been like 12 guys since Jim Ryan did it back in the 60s. I think it was 1964 or so. There's only been 12 high schoolers that have ever broken a 4-minute mile.
Mm-hmm.
And this kid suddenly ran a 3:57 mile. And they asked him to explain it. And he said, I had to make a mental shift in my thinking. I no longer think of 3:57 as being fast. And he laughed and he said, but my parents still think 4 minutes is unbelievable. But I don't think of it that way anymore. And he said, I made a shift in my mindset. And I know now I'm going to run a lot faster than 3:57. I just don't know when. But it doesn't mean to me what it used to mean. And I think that's a good example of what we're talking about. I've used the example of Padraig Harrington winning the British Open for the first time. And no one from Ireland had done it. And I think it was 67 years. In the next 8 years, Rory won a bunch of majors. Darren Clark won the British Open. Graham McDowell won the Open. And Padraig's won a couple more. And I said, it's just amazing that once a player who wasn't a child prodigy won the Open, all of a sudden, a lot of other people started believing that they could win it. And so it had a huge impact. And, you know, I think we could probably argue that maybe Rory would have won a major or an Open no matter what, but we'll never know. All I know is that all of a sudden it became believable, and a lot of players did it after years of no one doing it. And I think that's what's so beautiful about the mind is, you know, can you conceive of it in your mind? Can you dare to believe it? And we all brag about living in America. America is a land of opportunity, and it gives us the opportunity to do whatever we want to do with our life. And part of my story is, isn't it amazing how many people have decided that all they want to do is be average? And it's the greatest cop-out in the world, because it's easy to say, well, if I'm just average, which is another word for mediocre or stuck in the middle, I can pretend I'm a huge success. So the other part of the human brain that's potentially self-limiting is our ability to rationalize. And so it's very easy to argue that, well, no, I'm just not that talented. And like, I've even had tour players come to me and say, well, you know, if I had Tiger Woods' talent, I'd be winning championships. And I look at them and I go, well, maybe you do have Tiger Woods' talent, but you don't think you do. And maybe Tiger Woods doesn't have any more talent than you, but he thinks he does. And so he had bigger ideas. And of course, it leads to a great discussion. But I mean, I think you have to take a look at it and say, well, if you had a coach who didn't think you had talent and therefore didn't believe you could be anything other than a bench warmer, how many of you would have been in love with that coach? And I don't think many people would be. And yet, when you decide for yourself that you don't have that much talent and that you could only be modestly good, you think you're being really smart. And so a lot of times you have to have a discussion with people about, so you went to college or to a university and you paid $65,000 a year to get this education. And when you went to the university, you thought you were brilliant and you thought you could do anything you put your mind to. And after 2 years of being in the university, wow, you started hanging around some other really talented, dedicated, hardworking kids. And you concluded after 2 years that I'm not as talented as I used to think I was. And boy, am I glad I spent all this money going to college to figure out that I can't do everything I used to think I could do. And I keep telling kids, if that's what you learned from your college education, boy, you learned a lot of the wrong stuff. But it happens to a lot of people. And whether it's a teacher, coach, or you came to this conclusion by yourself. You know, so anyways, that's why I started the book with, you know, some stories about that, because I think it's time for us to wake up and say, wait a minute, we live in a country that gives us the opportunity to do anything we want to do. Are you sure that this is all you want to do? And believe me, I don't tell people what their dream ought to be. I just remind people that all dreams are your ideas about your life. And why did you decide to find a goal that was what you called realistic?
Let me jump in. Riffing off of what you're saying here, Bob, but I find, like, as a parallel in business, if you set the goal too high, no one even tries. And so if you say this year we're going to sell 1 million widgets, and last year you sold 1,000, the sales team just sort of doesn't even try. Versus, you have to kind of, there's a Pareto optimization of where you need to pick your goal setting in a way that's motivating, but not deflating to there, right? So my question for you on a personal level is, I'm a 10 index. I love golf, obviously, do this podcast and everything else. Got a lot of other things going on. When I think about my goal setting, I mean, should I even focus on my index? Is that even the right way to even measure myself? Should I focus on the quality of how I hit balls? I mean, how do you set the goal? How does a player like me set his goal? And what is a realistic goal to set?
Well, let's begin with that last point. I spend a lot of my life convincing people that most people who set so-called realistic goals in my world have found a way to justify negative thinking and limit themselves, okay? I have no problem, if we go back to where you started, with someone telling me I sold 1,000 widgets, and it's crazy for me to think I'm going to do 1 million this year. Unless I really strike it rich, I got to really hit the right company at the right time. Okay, so I'm not going to say it's impossible to do 1 million if you've done 1,000, but you'd have to get one heck of a good deal with somebody. I think you have to take a look at the difference between long-term goals and short-term goals. Like if you're a 10 handicap and you say, my dream is to be a scratch golfer. First thing I'd say is, I think you have to believe that that's possible. Now you have to, the second thing is, well, how long is it going to take for me to get from 10 to scratch? And then how much time and energy am I going to have to put into it? And do I have the time and energy to do that? And sometimes with people, you look like you might be 30, 35 years old.
A little older, but that's
and
cool.
And aging quickly.
Yeah, aging quickly, yeah.
But no, I mean, the point is, sometimes people come to me and say, you know, Doc, I love the 2 days with you, but right now I can't put the time and energy into it that I need to get where I want to get to. I'm going to come back in 5 years or in 10 years, and then I'm going to really be set with my family, with my finances, with my company, to really put more time and energy into it. And then, man, I really love what we're talking about. And then it's putting the practice plan together that, okay, like sometimes people say, I have an hour 4 days a week. Well, the first thing I'm going to tell them, well, you better be spending a lot of that time on your short game. Because if you're not spending it on your short game, no matter how good you hit the ball, you're not going to get down to scratch if you don't have an unbelievable short game. And I'm going to tell them, you better have a great mind. And anybody can have a great mind. It doesn't take 1 million hours a day to have a great mind. So don't use a lack of skill as a reason for thinking poorly when you're standing over a shot or putt. That makes no sense. I think you have to take a look at it. But I think it's okay to be so-called realistic short-term, but I think that's different than long-term, or if you have a 10-year plan or a 5-year plan, and then it's like, can you consistently stick to your plan? So that's why we talk a lot in the book about, can you be an optimist? Can you be patient? Can you be persistent? You know, a lot of people have trouble sustaining a commitment when they don't see the progress on a day-to-day basis. And if you're going to get good at golf, you're probably going to go backwards a whole bunch of times before you get a benefit of the changes you make. And a lot of people, it's interesting how comfortable people get with habits that don't work, but they're comfortable with them and they want to run back to what they're comfortable with rather than doing something that's very uncomfortable in order to get really better.
Yeah.
And so, that's where you need to have a good relationship with yourself, with your teacher, with, you know, all the people that are on your team that are going to help you get better.
Yeah. So Dr. Bob, I grew up in poverty. And as I read your book, it's a little embarrassing to say this because it's probably not the reaction most people give to reading your book, but there were parts in there where I got a little emotional. Because if I didn't believe the things that you wrote about, I would not be where I am today.
Yep.
One of the things you talked about that also really resonated with me, and I think I get it right, got this in the right order, but focusing on the possible rather than the probable. People look at statistics and they convince themselves that so few people or nobody has ever done something, so therefore it's not probable. And so they don't try. Or they don't aim high enough. And I heard so many times when I was a kid how impractical, how unrealistic my dreams were. And how, rather than dreaming of being a businessman that traveled around the world, if I could just graduate from high school, I would have beat the odds. And I made the decision, and you say this in the book, I think, but in sort of a different way. I made the decision that I wasn't going to allow other people's fears or limitations to determine what my own goals in life would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so applying that to the golf game. Now I can go out and play terrible at times, but if I focus and stay in the moment and take one shot at a time, I usually play much better golf. Yesterday I played at East Lake. At East Lake, I'm always, if I break 90, I'm happy. Because we're usually playing back. And if I break 90, I'm happy. Yesterday, I was fighting to break 80. And just, I was so, and I ended up at 82. So again, I set that goal to break 80. And your statistics probably would tell you I was going to shoot somewhere between 78 and 82. I shot 82. Like Padraig did at Wingfoot, I bogeyed the last three holes. but the things you write about, and you write about it in relationship to golf, and you write about it in relationship to life. I think I'm a living example at times, and those principles are real and they work.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I've written a lot about possibilities versus probabilities because I think it's a huge topic. And I mean, I think sometimes we get bogged down in probabilities. And, you know, I did a chapter on stats. I think there's a place for it. In other words, it'd be very hard to play on tour if you were averaging 7 greens. You know, I mean, it's hard to be a scratch golfer if you're averaging 7 greens. Quite improbable, but it's possible. But you'd have to have the greatest short game, you know, on the planet Earth. And, you know, I've written a lot about the idea that we create our own reality. And people a lot of times, what's that mean? I go, well, we just make up this thing called life in our head. In other words, we're all born to a mother in some small town or big city. Some come from poverty, some come from wealth. And you get to decide what you want to do. And it's like, people say, so is it all in your head? I go, no. But it's a lot of it's in your head to get you to develop a work ethic. I mean, in other words, do you have to have a work ethic? Do you have to have discipline? Do you have to have dedication? Do you have to have a sustained commitment? Yeah. I mean, sometimes you have to outwork people. I mean, there are great golfers who are child prodigies. You know, I could probably say probably 5 or 6 of the top eight or nine players in the world were child prodigies. But there's another four that weren't. So, I mean, it means it's possible. And it's like, are you willing to take whatever you got and love your stuff? And so I talk about that a lot with players. And they'll say, well, what do you mean I got to love my stuff? I said, well, you're going to take yourself to the golf course, your talent, your personality, your ability, every time you go to the course. And you better love your stuff because it's what you got to play with on that day. And then you got to keep at it until it gets better. And a lot of times people, you know, they'll say to me, well, you know, Doc, I'm really applying myself and my scores aren't coming down yet. And I go, yeah, yep, that's the way it is. Yep, that's pretty normal. And well, when is it going to fall into place? I don't know. I just know if you keep doing all the right stuff, eventually it will. It's just how it works. And it works that way for pretty much everybody who isn't just born to the game and came by it naturally and easily. And I have no idea why those prodigies came by it so easily and readily. I mean, I don't know why someone could shoot par golf when they're 5 or 7 years old. It makes no sense. I don't understand why someone understands physics. I often use the example, being a sophomore in college, and I went to Catholic schools, and a nun stood up at the board on the first day of geometry class and diagrammed the hypotenuse of a triangle. And I remember looking at her on that board and going, what in God's name is she talking about? And she erased it and looked at the class and said, would someone like to come up here and diagram it and explain what I just taught you? And the girl behind me was jumping out of her seat to go up to the board. And she went up and explained it. Now, 2-3 weeks later, I got it. But I remember being in shock that this gal already got it, you know? So, I mean, we all come by some things easier and quicker. Like, I mean, I probably for some reason have an understanding of the mind and how to get people to play better and get better than I do some other things in life. I have no idea why this comes pretty easy to me. But I go back to my hometown and kids will ask me, how do you come from a little town in Rutland, Vermont? My dad was a barber. How do you get to do the stuff you do? And there's a side of me that says, I have no clue. You know, it still amazes me. But I said, I don't think anybody cares where you come from. I don't think anybody cares if you were born rich or poor. All they really want to know is, can you help me in my quest for my dream? And so a lot of times I tell people, like sometimes people introduce me, Rotel is a shrink. I'm not a shrink. I'm an enlarger. I'm a dream maker. I'm not a shrink. I had no interest in shrinking anybody, you know? It's like, I want to expand people's horizons. But, I mean, get people to understand that a lot of stuff we make up, like where you come from or what kind of family you come from or how good were you at 12, it's like, it doesn't matter. It's just irrelevant. It's like really about where do you want to go? Now, is it easier if you find something that you're passionate about that you also have some talent at? Yeah, that would help. But a lot of people I work with, they just want to see. Like I can think of even people like Tom Kite in the Hall of Fame. I mean, his quest was to chase his potential. All he wanted to do, I want to find out how good I can get at golf. And, you know, Padraig would be that way. A lot of people I work with would be that way. I remember in the last month or so, Justin Thomas didn't really have his A game where he wanted during the FedEx playoffs. And I think he probably finished like in the top five in every one of them. And for him, that was a huge success. He was so proud of how great he played, even when his physical game wasn't where he wanted to. And he loved how he fought and he hung in there and he got his mind in a good place. And he felt like, I got everything I could out of my game where it's at right now. You know,
Aaron.
Yeah.
This stuff resonates with me because it's sort of my lived experience. Yeah. But what are your thoughts on this approach? And what would you challenge Dr. Rotella on?
Well, first of all, anytime you tell me your narrative, Jimmy, I'm moved and it's incredible. And that is why I'm so happy to share this podcast with you. and the winner that you are. I understand where you're coming from, Dr. Attella, and you are the mental expert on this. But I always kind of reflect on, look, we're all trying to get different things out of golf, right? And I'm not trying to become a champion. I'm not trying to become my club champion. I don't know what I'm trying to do, right? I know it's not champion, but it's somewhere between my current state and a club champion, and certainly not beyond that. And I'm not being negative. I'm being positive. I'm being happy. I'm expressing my goals going forward. I think, and here's a very specific question for you though, and I'm going to pick your brain on this. I think I don't know how to focus. So hear me out on this. You're standing above a 6-foot putt that matters. Okay. And you really want to make it. It's for something. It's, you know, and it's a net birdie that gets you to the next round and the member guests that your friend just invited you to. It's not for, you know, anything spectacular, but it's the net game that I play. And I'm sitting there and I read the putt and I have a sense of the pace and we're plenty warmed up. It's not early in the round. And then I say, okay, I say something wrong. This is the mental gap that the 10 index player has. I'm sure the elite player has it too, but what is it that you do in that moment? I guess it's you act positive. You stay positive, say, I can make the 6-footer, but then I don't know if I'm just massively attention deficit disorder or what, but I don't know how you get your brain to actually focus. If I'm relaxed and I don't even think about it, I could roll that putt in, but I don't do that. I do something different and I deliver it. And I know it's just all between my ears, the mistake I'm making, but how do you advise on finding your focus in the moments that count at the level that you want to be?
Well, it's interesting. I probably don't use the word focus hardly ever because I think it really is the wrong idea for people. When you're in the right place, it's probably going to feel like you're not focused. It's much closer to being out to lunch and not caring about the outcome at all. You said it a minute ago. You know, if I was just not doing anything, I go unconscious. So, I mean, I use the example. If you went out back, let's say you played baseball as a kid. You ever played baseball? If you went out back and played catch with someone, you would just look at the glove and throw the ball, and it would go to the other guy's glove. But you wouldn't be trying to focus on the glove. I call it a soft focus. But you would look at the glove, but you wouldn't even be aware that you're looking at the glove.
Yeah.
But you would just do it. Okay?
Yeah.
Like I played quarterback in football, and I had 3 or 4 different receivers that all ran at a different speed. No one ever told me or asked me, how do you know how far to lead receivers that all run at different speeds? I go, I don't know. Never asked that question. Never thought about it, but I always knew how to do it. I played college basketball. When I shot a jump shot, I never thought about making it or not making it. I just looked and shot. It's a very unconscious state. And it's interesting you talk about being positive and focused. That's something you do away from the putt. So like away from a putt, I'm seeing it go in. So, I mean, that's a mental process, it's just we could call it. But actually over the ball, I'm doing a process that's so unconscious where once I'm set up, I'm just looking and doing. And if you ask me anything about my stroke, I'd go, I have no clue. I'm just looking where I want it to go, and something called a stroke happens. I have no awareness of the stroke. If you ask me, how did I know how hard to hit it? I go, I have no clue.
I think this is the big, this is very powerful. Well, I was saying, I think this is what you just said is incredibly powerful to me. What I'm hearing you say is you're giving me permission to not be so in my head when I putt it, to just let it go. I guess the mistake I've been making all these years is I thought you had to focus like hyper focus, like straight back, straight through, thinking of the angle, but you're just saying, just do it.
Players in the world in the Ryder Cup, if they haven't learned to get unconscious, like everyone talks about, I'm nervous they're going to be on the first tee. Well, what great players learn is the more butterflies I have going on in my body, I have learned I always play better when I've got that because I can't think. Okay. I mean, when you're on that first tee, you can't think of anything. When you're on the last tee at Augusta, time for the lead, you go so unconscious, and all you can do is look where you want the ball to go and let a swing happen. It's like you're out there playing naked, but your subconscious takes over and you have to learn to get comfortable being that unconscious. Like if I work with a rock and roll singer who plays the guitar, they'll always tell me they always play the guitar better when they're singing because they can't think about playing the guitar. The drummers will tell me, even if they're not supposed to sing, they sing because they totally go unconscious with the drumming. Okay. And that's hard for people to understand because I'm asking them to go unconscious when they're playing for $2 million or the club championship or to beat your buddy out of a dollar. And I tell people, well, think about it like this. I went to graduate school for 6 years to spend my life teaching people to not think. So think how ridiculous that sounds. I remember my mother asking me years ago, she said, Bobby, you're making a living teaching people to not think? I go, yeah, isn't that unbelievable, Mom?
That's awesome. It's,
what you really want is a quiet mind. And that's why when people ask about meditating, I said, well, you know, maybe 20% of my players meditate. But really, when you're golfing over the golf, when you're standing over the golf ball, it's a meditative or hypnotic state where you're mesmerized. And when you're mesmerized, nothing in the world exists but where you want the ball to go. And this is where it gets tricky. So you're into the target, but you're not into caring about the outcome of the shot.
So
that's where it gets tricky.
So Dr. Otello, I was at the PGA Championship that Phil won.
Yeah.
At Kiowa.
Yeah.
And throughout that weekend, Phil said he was focusing on focusing. Yeah. And I actually got it, what he was talking about. And for me, when I talk about focusing on the golf course, it means I'm present. Okay. I'm not off somewhere else. I'm present. And it's not focusing on my takeaway, not focusing on my path. Because when I do that, I have too much tension. And like you said, if you ask me about what did I do in my technique differently yesterday at East Lake? I can't tell you. I just know I hit the ball a lot better because I stayed at East Lake. I didn't wander off to all these other places. And I just relaxed. And I didn't think about, am I getting enough turn? Am I coming from the inside? Am I coming over the top? I just swung the club. And the ball,
it's so again, let's go back to the example of playing catch in the backyard with a baseball or a football. You wouldn't be thinking about whether your hand was aimed. You wouldn't be thinking about your weight transfer. You'd just be looking where you want it to go, and you'd throw it. And you'd totally trust it would go there. So the body relaxes if your mind is quiet, but quiet is just looking where you want the ball to go. Now, when you mentioned Phil said he was focused on focusing, well, he's not going to take an hour to try to explain what that means, but all Phil's doing is seeing a shot and hitting a shot. It's hard. It's a tricky thing. It takes a lot of time to get people to understand what it really means to have your head there because it's closer to feeling like you're out to lunch. I mean, but you're not out to lunch because all you're doing is seeing the shot you want or seeing – where you want the ball to go.
Oh, like, let me ask this. Just to go deeper on this, because I understand what you're saying. I definitely get what you're saying.
But we're going deeper on something that's unbelievably simple.
Okay, but let me ask you
about it. Yeah.
Okay. Look, you've made your whole career. You've been in going deeper on this. But I get it with a putt. But like, I know currently I'm working on a particular move with the driver. And, yep. You know, the pro says this is what you should do. And I know what I need to do. And it's a swing change. Okay.
Okay.
So at which point do I think about that? I mean, that's not having a catch. That's like, I am trying to do something different. On the range, I get it. I could work on it, whatever. But when I get on the first tee, if I go totally unconscious, I don't know. Wouldn't I go back to my original form and not to the new swing that I'm trying to get to? Like, how do you deal with that?
Well, that's a brilliant question. It comes up a lot. Well, first of all, I've explained in some other books, if you look at a beginner is unconsciously incompetent. Okay, so they're very unconscious, but they're doing everything wrong. An intermediate performer is defined as consciously becoming competent. An advanced performer is unconsciously competent. Okay, so now the question is, should I think consciously on the golf course if I want to play my best today? Well, I make a deal with the devil sometimes. And the deal I'll make is I'll let you have one conscious thought with your long game until you've done so many repetitions that the correct move becomes unconscious and a dominant habit, okay? But the other part of the deal is you have to go unconscious with your short game. Because the short game is actually where you have to be the most athletic. Because every pitch and bunker shot is a creative experience. I can teach almost anybody to learn how to hit the golf ball. They may not hit it as far as a tour player, but they can learn to repeat it. But you don't have to be a real good athlete to do that. Having hand-eye coordination and being athletic is probably way more important than becoming a great pitcher, bunker player, and putter. And there, I tell guys, you got to be unconscious. You got to be just seeing it and doing it. So I kind of tell them I'm making a deal with the devil. If you'll do this with your short game, I'll let you cheat a little on your long game because you could get away with it. Like sometimes people ask me, are you telling me I can't hit a golf shot thinking about my swing? I go, well, you've already hit a golf shot thinking about your swing. Why would you even have to ask me? You already know you can. It's just that under tournament pressure, it would be very difficult to do. Like everyone talks about Bryson being a scientist. I said, well, he's hired a lot of people that have helped him develop a lot of information that's based on science. But when he's swinging, you can tell from the speed of his backswing and front, he is unconscious and he's letting it rip. There's no tight, careful, conscious thought going on, you know, but he's done a lot of repetitions. I tell people, if the world made sense, you would do a lot more practicing without a golf ball and without a target. So in a dream world, if I ruled the game of golf, and I don't, I tell people, you know, in your house, stand in front of a mirror and do 50 to 100 swings a day thinking about your swing. But don't ever think about your swing when there's a ball and a target. That would be my dream for people from what I know. You know, go work on your swing, but separate working on your swing from hitting golf balls to a target.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That would be the ideal.
Yeah. You know? So, Doc.
The problem is you say, well, I'm not going to take 100 swings a day. Well, it's going to take a lot longer for it to become a dominant habit.
Yeah. So Doc, the first time, I don't know if you remember this or not, but the first time I ever shot even par on, and it was for 9 holes, was we were paired together during our weekend warriors at Glenmore.
Do I remember it? You were like floating. your feet didn't even hit the ground.
Yeah. So we were riding in the cart together, and you had these small index cards, and you were taking notes the whole time. I have no idea what you were writing, but you were taking notes.
I think I was saying, this guy is a god of golf or something.
Yeah. and so we finished a round, and you said, Jimmy, let's go to the range. You have me hit, I think it was like either 3 to 5 balls. You never said anything to me about takeaway, setup, or anything. You took, and it was, we have Titleist practice balls on the range. You put the Titleist name sort of on that inside corner, and you just said, hit Titleist. That was it. And no, the ball flew straight. And that let me know I could hit the ball straight. You didn't
think about how you learn to throw a baseball or throw a football. I tell people, I didn't learn from an instruction manual. You know, I watched players that were good, and somehow I imitated them. But I didn't know what I was doing. I don't even know if I knew I was imitating them. But I didn't know if I was doing it correct or not. But it was a picture. At some point, you have to find a way to be athletic. And basically, I define being athletic as playing with your eyes and your instincts. So you're looking where you want it to go, and motion happens in response to that. So you could argue that a golf swing is something that happens in response to what you're picturing in your brain, rather than trying to make a golf swing happen. Get your head in the right place, and we can cause a swing to happen without thinking about it. And so a lot of times you have to find the easiest way possible to get someone to create motion that's fluid. And, you know, rhythm plays a big role, certainly with all of the game. You know, it's nice if you have some rhythm and flow to what you're doing. But I don't know how anybody could get in a flow state if they weren't unconscious. Like, I'm sitting here with a player who's a surfer. You know, and I promise you, when he's surfing, that just like when you're skiing, you're just looking and reacting. You know, like I have a niece who's a good skier, and I tell her to just pretend she's a little bird sitting on the skis, you know, and like some genius designed the skis with edges. And if you just ride them, they'll carve out the snow. And I mean, but you have to react instinctively and intuitively. Now, does experience enhance that? Yeah. But I mean, that's where the game gets tricky. There's no question about it. And some of it, let's face it, the top players spend a lot of hours every day, you know.
Can I ask you a psychology question? I think I know the answer, but I find when I'm playing match play, you know, it's just a hole by hole thing. I get a hole max, I'm out of the hole, hole's over, brand new hole, next hole. I am so much better than stroke play. It's like if I had a handicap for match play versus stroke metal play, I would be a much lower handicap for metal play somehow. Or, you know, that I know that doesn't exactly work, but I'm a better player.
Most of the world of golfers would agree with you, which is why I always argue that match play isn't real golf for those people who think it is. Metal play is real golf, where you have to count every shot and every stroke, and then you have to post a score. Like, a lot of times, it's amazing in match play tournaments at the club level, everyone comes in, oh yeah, I was 4 under, but I got beat. I mean, he was unbelievable today. It's like, wait a minute, you never break 80. Today you shot 4 under? You know, when you don't have to post a score, it's easy to say you shot 4. You know, so I mean, I think real golf is when you have to count every shot. And it gets back to Jimmy's point about playing in the present moment, and that's where the title of the book, Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot, comes from. That, you know, that shot's over. People are, well, I just hit it in the right trees. How am I supposed to accept it and like it? And the answer is, because that's where your ball is. And you have to go play from there. And you can either hate it or be upset about it or fight it or accept it and say, okay, I got to go score now. This is where my ball is. And like you were talking about Phil Mickelson, Phil's whole approach has been all the birdies are in the trees. which simply means I'm going to take my driver and rip it. And once it's in the woods, I know I'm going to make birdie from over here. This is going to be even more fun than if I hit it in the fairway. Arnold Palmer had a great philosophy. He said, all you got to do is hit one good shot per hole, and I'd rather it not be my first one. I mean, think how brilliant that statement is. As long as your miss is in play, go get the ball and get in the hole. No one cares how you do it. And a lot of people get so lost in their golf swing. So to get back to your point about the golf swing, it's like once you're on the golf course, playing golf is simply finding a way with whatever you've got today to go get the ball in the hole. And that's what really good players learn to get good at doing.
Yeah. So one other part of the, there were several parts of the book, as I said earlier, that resonated with me, but one.
No, all other, parts of the book are quite brilliant.
They are just exceptionally brilliant. You talk a lot too about persistence and perseverance.
Yeah.
Determination. Yeah. And so where I would relate that is obviously to my life, but I'll talk about it in something more just a discrete segment. And that was when I was doing the top 100 courses. The first time it really hit me was I was at Plainfield Country Club. I was on the Plainfield was my 34th course. On the sixth hole, par three, almost holed out for a hole in one. And I tapped in for my par, and I recognize that I'm 1/3 of the way finished. Then it hits me that when you're 1/3 of the way finished with something, you got twice as many more to do. And I thought about all that work that I had done to get to 1/3 and just the weight of it. And so to go on at that point too, it's, you can be overwhelmed. It can be overwhelming to you. The other time I faced the challenge of how hard what I was doing was when it looked like I wasn't going to get to 100 because my Shinnecock round got canceled. And it was a couple of weeks before the U.S. Open. And Shinnecock had limited their membership to only bringing a few guests per year. And everybody had pretty much used up their guests. And if they hadn't, they had it allocated to somebody, not some stranger. You know, fortunately for me, Jimmy Don came to the rescue, but I played the last 10 courses or so with the idea that I probably was not going to play Shinnecock. And the whole thing was to get the 100 done in 1 year. And so looking at the possible and probable, it was still possible, but very improbable. To not give up at that point, that was hard. But if I had given up, I obviously wouldn't have done it. And the difference between having done it and having not done it is when my biggest hopes and dreams came up against my biggest challenges. I call it the intersection of adversity and aspirations. I didn't quit.
Yeah. And I'd say
that's
everyone,
what makes the difference.
Well, and that's why a lot of people don't set really big dreams and ambitions because, you know, they don't want to have to deal with the adversity. They don't want to have to deal with the doubts and the fears. You know, it's like, you know, some people just might not be important enough to them. But I mean, I think in golf, I think people constantly come to those roadblocks. And I keep telling people, hey, golf is a lot of fun. But to get really good at it, it's really hard. It's a difficult game. You know, Michael Jordan was with Steph Curry the other day, and he did an interview, and he said, oh, it's definitely the hardest sport I've ever played. It's way harder than basketball or baseball. Like, yeah, that means it's pretty hard. And so, I mean, I think you have to acknowledge it. Most of the people that I work with are like, they love the fact that it's really hard, and most people don't ever stick with it long enough to get really good at it because they just can't deal with it. And some people just say, I don't have the time. Some people, I don't have the interest. But I mean, it's a difficult game. But the other thing that's interesting, you know, I'm a pretty good player.
Yes, a very good player. I mentioned that to Aaron earlier.
I've got our course record of 62, so I've shot 11, 10 under. I've won the national junior senior. It's like, you know, I've gotten pretty good. But when I talk to the tour players, they'll say, you know, Rotella, you'd fly around the world to help me win a tournament, but you wouldn't fly around the world to win a tournament. And they look at me and say, you know, Doc, the difference between you and me is I'd fly around the world to win a golf tournament. I wouldn't go next door to help someone else win a tournament. And I go, yeah, I don't know why I love helping people with their dreams more than I love golf. And I like golf a lot. But I'm probably I'm not as committed to being a great golfer as I am to being a great sports psychologist. You know, I'm probably not as committed to golf as I am to having a great family life. But I'm pretty committed. I mean, I spend quite a bit of time at it. But it's just not at the top of my priority list. So, I mean, I have my career, my family, and then golf, you know, is kind of the way I'd look at it. And I think everyone has to decide. I mean, there are people on tour who have golf way up at the top of their list.
Well, it's been fun. It's been fun, Doc. And the book is Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot. It's an easy read. I actually read it in one sitting because it flows. You get into it and it flows very easily.
And
for me, like I said, there was so much of it that resonated with me. So I would recommend that our listeners download a copy like I did, or stop by the bookstore. Simon & Schuster's your publisher. Stop by the bookstore, pick up a copy. But it's definitely worth the read.
Yeah, it's been fun. Don't just buy one for yourself. Buy one for your friends.
Absolutely. It's been fun. Aaron, any final
great
words?
Great being with Eric and Jimmy.
I feel like really good. My next net game is going to be good. I'm going to go 4 under net. It's going to be awesome.
Eric, they can't see you, but you're looking good.
Thank you.
Yeah. So,
all right, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doc. So, Aaron, what do you think? You know, I've known Dr. Rotella for, I guess, over 20 years now. No, it hasn't been 20 years. I haven't been playing golf that long. So I've known him for as long as I've played golf. And I started playing golf when I was 45, and I'm 62 now. So I guess I've known him for 17 years. And so what are your thoughts on how he approaches improving your game?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in media, things my friends are talking about. There's so many people are sort of moved to be more mindful. I haven't yet found my way to the worldview of being mindful. I've tried it. I've listened to some of these, you know, headspace kind of meditations. It doesn't fully work for me. But what I think I got out of today is that, what did he say? He said it's sort of hypnotic meditation. When you're finally ready to swing, you just don't think about things. You just do your thing. And I think the big mistake I've been making is I've been thinking that I to do something well, I need to focus. But I don't even know what that really means. And so I think he gave me a new permission tonight to just let it go and just go for that putt the way you would throwing a baseball with Jordan in your backyard. Like just do it. And then I also liked the second thing I got out of it that I thought was like actionable for my next member guest or what have you, was the deal with the devil that he said, where he said, you know, we can sort of allow ourselves one swing thought on maybe one part of our game. If we're really trying to work on something, that's okay. That's okay. Not advised, but it's okay. So those are my two big takeaways. And I really appreciate that he took the time with us and that you set it up, Jimmy. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
No, it was fun talking to him. And, you know, when I talk about a question for you on, What's the lowest score you've ever shot?
79. I mean, so embarrassed to say.
When you think about that, why are you embarrassed to say that? That you don't. That probably 99% of golfers have never broken 80. So 79, and not that we're comparing scores or anything like that, but 79 in anybody's book is never embarrassing to say, I don't think, as a recreational golfer. But anyway, when you shot that 79, do you really know what you did so much differently in your swing than what you do the other times?
No, I don't. And this is going to sound maybe the opposite of the Dr. Rotella philosophy of positiveness, but I kind of felt like when it happened that everything went right. I made a putt that like normally never make. I made, you know, the ball that would bounce out, be bounce inbounds. You know, it was like every single thing went right to an extent that I was like, oh man, like,
okay, so why did you make that putt? What was so good about your putting that made you make that putt? That's what I'm saying is you can't really think about, you can't say, oh, I squared the club face 100% on that putt and hit my line exactly because I held the putt this way with my grip, or you just putted it and it went in. That's the point, is that that's the freeing up your mind. And literally yesterday, after, I think my best score prior to yesterday at Eastlake, and Eastlake can be hard because of it's long and you got the Bermuda rough and there's water all over the place. But I was thinking to myself as I was driving home after the round, I can't describe why I hit so many greens, why my shot was so much better and hit so many fairways and greens. Yesterday, all I can say is I stayed in the moment. I focused. I was there. But I can't tell you what I did better. As far as I know, I didn't really do anything technique any differently than I always do.
I think the thing you said about focus, that actually is a very helpful thing that for you. I mean, I constantly get distracted. I don't check my phone at all on the course because I know that's a recipe for disaster. So I leave the phone in the bag, but you can't help it but think, oh man, it's September and my car inspection sticker needs to be replaced. And, oh, when am I going to fit that in? This and that, you know, your mind races. And it sounds like what you did at Eastlake is at least you just stayed on each hole. You know, you kept your brain going, playing golf, not thinking about your car inspection sticker. So it was cool. I'm, you know what? I think the it's almost like there needs to be a post podcast debrief on this because I want to go take this out on the course and see what this all means. I will say that the one experience I had playing with the most athletic person I ever got a chance to play with, besides you, Jimmy, was I got paired with Ray Allen once. And I mean, you know, he's not a classically trained golfer. His putting was off the charts. I mean, you didn't need to know that he was a celebrity. The athleticism of his putting was unbelievable. It was like draining 3-point shots. And I'm sure he was just, I mean, it was just feel. It's just feel and looking at the ball and hitting it at the right pace. And I mean, it was pretty awesome to watch. So I'm going to try to channel my inner Ray Allen this weekend at the member 2-day member guest that we have coming up.
Well, it's good. How about you? It's good to kick off this new season. I'm glad we've got Arcos as our proud sponsor to our podcast. And I think it fits right in with what we're talking about today and taking the guessing out of your game and having the data to actually know what areas to work on. So it's great to have them as a sponsor, and I hope our listeners take advantage of their products and the discount that they get, that 15% discount they get if they
put in golf nuts. Golf Nuts, just put that in as a discount code on the Arcos Golf website. And I promise I won't read the script on future episodes, but I will talk about Arcos briefly on each episode because they're helping us out this year. We appreciate it. Anyhow, we'll take it. Until next time. Take it easy.
You too, Aaron.